So we're doing something a little bit different this morning in Steadfast. You know, we're in the middle of this series, or towards the end of it now. Not ready. Are you ready to tie the knot? And we'll see if the AV is not ready. Or there it is. Okay. So we've covered the topic of, do you have the same master? Do you have the same mission? Is there the right maturity? And we're looking now, our second week, on, are there the means? What are the means that you would want for marriage? And how do you deal with just practically finances in marriage or preparing for marriage? And so I've decided to cover these topics. I mentioned to them to you last week, and that is how to budget, how to assess cash flow, dealing with debt, balancing assets, large purchases, and giving. So that's kind of our outline for today. I do have a packet available for you. So in case the screens blank out on us, if you want to go to that QR code, there is a 16 or 17 page document that has a number of the charts that I'll be bringing up. And it is a packet put together by Jim Rickert from Stewardship Services. And he gave this to me years ago, but I found it very helpful in premarital counseling, in financial counseling for others. And so we'll be taking a sampling from that, and I'll try and alert you to those page numbers just in case you're sitting far enough back that you can't see some of the slides that I have here on the screen. You can look at it maybe on your phone or device. So let's talk a bit about budgeting. Budgeting is important because it is a tool that can help families live below their means. And that's really the key idea here, is that your means are the actual finances that are coming in. And so if you're going to live below your means, you're going to be spending less than you earn. I know that's a novel concept. That's right. You just spend less than you bring in. And so when we talk about budgeting, it's an issue of wisdom. The borrower is a slave to the lender, is Proverbs 22:7. Psalm 37:21, the wicked borrows and does not pay back. So the Bible teaches that if you borrow, you should pay back. Proverbs 21:20, there's desirable treasure and oil in the abode of the wise, but a foolish man swallows it up. And so it's just an issue of wisdom. Are you able to live below your means? And budgeting is simply a tool. Not everybody needs to budget, because some people don't come anywhere near the spending the means that God has given them. But it's helpful from time to time to see what your budget is and see how you're stewarding the funds that God has blessed you with. Sometimes there is confusion on this. In Romans 13, verse 8, it says, owe nothing to anyone except to love one another. And so some people interpret that as, well, we should never have any sort of debt. And there, if it's your conviction that you never want to have any sort of financial debt, that's fine. But I don't believe that Romans 13:8 means that the Bible forbids borrowing and lending. The idea there is that you should not be perpetually owing someone in a sense where you just can't repay them. It's not talking about obligation. The Old Testament made certain regulations for lending to those who were in need, both in Exodus 22 and Leviticus 25. And Jesus taught on the Sermon on the Mount that you should give to him who asks you, and do not turn away from him who wants to borrow from you, Matthew 5:42. So it seems like there are provisions and regulations and guidelines in the Scripture for borrowing and lending. And though it's not ideal, and that's something we want to avoid, especially going into debt to the extent where you cannot meet your obligations, or whether you're, or where your spending is being eaten up by interest. And there are plenty of banks and credit companies out there that would love to take advantage of you. So it's important. I think I felt like I wanted to spend at least one Sunday morning here in Steadfast talking about some of the basics. And some of you, this will be, you know, oh, I already knew that. And hopefully there'll be something for everyone here. But it's really just getting a handle on your finances, even at a young age, making sure that you are set up well for marriage and family. If you're looking to start a budget, One easy way would be to fill out a budget worksheet. I'm trying to zoom in here a little bit on this, but the idea is that you just have a chart here and you have the 12 months of the year, and then you have all the normal expenditures that you would have in a month. And each month at the end of the month, you go through your bank statement, you go through your bank account, you go through your credit card spending or whatever, cash spending, and you actually keep a record of, hey, what did you give? What did you put into savings? What did you spend on rent? What did you or mortgage or utilities or repairs or auto? And you go through all these different categories. There were times where I was in Africa where people would come to me, and in Africa there's some different challenges because there are no social system. There's no services for medical help and so forth. And so the whole continent really survives off of people helping one another with their finances. And I would actually use a sheet like this to help people keep track of what they're spending each month. And after about 3 months, it becomes pretty clear what you're spending. And then for some of those people, just a basic idea, I would tell them to put their money in envelopes based off of what their budget is. So if your rent is a certain amount per month, then you put that rent in the rent envelope. Once your salary comes in, if you've got giving, you put that in the giving envelope. If you've got transportation, put that in transportation envelope. If you've got food, put that in the food envelope. And then make a separate envelope simply for helping family, because the culture there requires that you will help family. And that way, I would tell African young people that if somebody comes to you and they said, I need help, can you help me? And you say, yes, I've got an envelope just for that, and I can help you out of that envelope. And if that envelope's empty, and then, because here's the problem, in Africa, if you have money, you feel obligated to give it, even if it should be designated for something else. So part of a budget, it doesn't mean that you can't borrow from other places within the budget. It just means that you need to make those decisions wisely. So, for example, in Africa, when somebody runs out of the envelope goes empty for helping family members, and another family member comes to them and says, hey, I need some help, you can say to them, listen, I really do want to help you. I can't give you out of this envelope because it's for my rent, and it's already obligated to someone else. And I can't give you out of this envelope because it's for food, and it really is the bare minimum of what we need for food for this month. But I can give you out of my transport because I will walk this month. I'll spend the rest of this month walking to work so that you can use my transport money. And that's the sacrifice I'm willing to make for you. And those are some of the decisions you'll have to make. Where can I borrow from? Where can I cut back? What is essential and what is not essential? And that was such a relief to many of the people that were in our churches there, because all of a sudden they realized, I can actually tell someone I don't have the money to lend you right now, because even though they had money, that was already had spoken for somewhere else or obligated to someone else. This is a pretty simplistic way, is just take a sheet of paper and start keeping track of where your spending goes. But most people nowadays, they'll come up with some sort of a Excel spreadsheet. I put this one together. I know that it's kind of hard to see, but basically I just made a mock sheet here of a basic budget for 2026. I included expenditures from an income from January, February, March, because April's not over yet, so you can't really put everything in there. And so if you look at here, I have different categories of income, first of all. And so the income is like your salary. Let's say your salary is $2,000 a month. That's pretty much going to stay the same. That goes in there. Maybe you have other income. Maybe you have a side business. You're selling things on eBay, or I don't know. You're doing something that brings in other income. It's a side job. And that varies from month to month. So that put in there. And then maybe gifts receives. Maybe you had a really good Christmas, and so in January you deposit a bunch of money in there. But nothing came in February. Maybe your birthday was in March, and so you had some money come in. And you're just putting in these different categories, and you're looking at your total income per month. And then you're looking at your expenditures, which will also vary. And then over on this far end, what I have down here is I have a 12-month total, which is not complete yet because there's only 3 months. But it automatically, you can put in the spreadsheet so that it just adds everything up. So it automatically changes it from month to month. And you can divide it by the number of months and see what your average is. Your monthly average right now is a lot lower because it's based off of 12 months. But you can also set your budget over here on the far right-hand corner so that you know what your income you should expect, what your outgo should be. And then at the bottom, you should look at your income minus your outgo, and you actually have $100 left over at the end of the year. That's kind of the end of each month. That's kind of the idea of a budget. But here, if you look at the income is this first section up here. And then I just set up this spreadsheet so that automatically the total number that is for each month is income goes to this line down here at the bottom. So it just transfers whatever number's in there, which is a sum of these three boxes, goes there. And then now you look at your expenditures. So you have auto, which includes maybe gas and fuel, insurance, maintenance, and maybe you have no maintenance 1 month, a huge expense the next, moderate expense the next. So it's going to vary. And then, but if you look at the average over the year, that helps you with your budget. And then beauty and hair, obviously I don't spend much on that. Your charity, your clothing, your dining out, entertainment, gifts. This would be like wedding gifts, or your charity would be more like giving to the church. These would be more like gifts to weddings, birthdays, things like that. Groceries, which again might vary from month to month, but average out. Household expenses, life insurance. Life insurance is something that people don't think about when they're single. Once you get married, you should start thinking about it, and especially when you have kids, because if you really believe that you want your wife to raise your kids and something happens to you as a young man, then you should make it possible so that if you were to die, that your wife could stay with your kids. And so that's something you should be thinking about if you're a young family, and vice versa. If she were to pass away, you want help. And even just thinking about, even if you're just married, it's very expensive to have a funeral nowadays. We're talking more than $10,000 for an average funeral. And so just having some sort of life insurance, when you're young, it's relatively inexpensive. And we could talk more about that if you want during the question times. But it's something that young people often don't think about, but they should. Your medical, if you have medical insurance, you're talking mainly co-pays or medications. Your miscellaneous spending. Your rent is going to be consistent. And I realize that these numbers are low, but you have to live in a place that is less than the means that you're earning. Again, your telephone. I mean, if you're on Cricket for two phones, there you go. Travel is something that people didn't used to budget for in years past, but nowadays people just see it as something that's regular for them. You should have some sort of savings, and then you look at your total income and your outgo, and that ends up with your cash flow. So the first month you did pretty good. You had $335 in the black. Your next month you overspent. You had some expensive car expenses and medical, and so you were over by $325, but you had that from the previous in your savings. In fact, you didn't even tap into your savings because this is your cash flow. It just came out of your cash flow. And then the next month you were negative 10, but that still came out. So it should average, is what I'm looking at. So any questions about budgeting? Before I take those questions, let me go one more slide. This is a general guideline. This is on page 9 of the Jim Rickard packet, but this is the idea that you just rough figures. It's going to vary from household to household, but your giving could be about 11%. Your housing could be 30 to 36%. Your food might be 14 to 16%. Auto, insurance, entertainment, it all should add up to about 100%. And in this case, he has your giving out of your gross income and the other expenses out of your net income. So it's going to be a little bit different as far as the total number. But that just gives you an idea of kind of what you should be hoping for. And of course, we'll talk about debt. So if you have credit, you kind of want to get rid of that. Okay, so we've talked about how to budget. I want to just take another quick look at assessing cash flow. Any questions before I go on with budgeting? Yes. Yeah, so that's a good question. The question is, if I have a set amount that I give to the church each month and I have an opportunity to give money to STMs, then, can I take money away from the church to give to the STM? First of all, giving should be free. Giving should be from the heart, and you have the freedom to give to whoever and however you want. We're going to be talking about that towards the end. So the short answer is, yeah, you can do that. I prefer to have a set amount that I commit to the local church, and then I have another set amount that kind of builds up that when I have STMs or other opportunities to give that I could give towards that. And so I kind of keep those numbers separate in my mind. So if we're looking at cash flow, you basically want to... Once your budget is set and your spending is consistent, you can actually start keeping track of what the income is on a monthly basis. So you add up your monthly income, and then you times it times 12 to get your annual income. And then you also want to do the same with all of your spending. So with your spending, you're going to actually take a look at what you're spending monthly on your offering, your house payment, insurance, auto, food, so forth, and then you times 12, and then you're going to go for look at your whole year. You're going to add it up at the bottom, and you're actually going to say, okay, my total income for the year is going to be this amount here. I'm going to subtract my outgo, and that's going to equal my cash flow. Okay, so your cash flow is actually how much you're actually you have an excess at the end of the year or at the end of a given month. And again, if you're living below your means, you should have a cash flow. And Jim Rickard has this little little saying here, when a man's outgo exceeds his income, his upkeep becomes his downfall. And so you need to try and make sure that your outgo doesn't exceed your income. All right. Along with that, I'm going to jump right into dealing with debt. And again, there's the QR code if you want to still grab these, but it'll come up again if you don't have it. Here is dealing with debt. So getting a handle on your debts, this is page 7 in the Jim Rickard packet if you want. But basically, you look at all of your debt, whether those be personal loans, auto loans, tuition loans, home loans, credit card. And then you are writing down the percentage that you're paying on interest. So first of all, I personally think it's just unwise to carry a balance on any credit card. If you don't have the money, don't spend it. If you use a credit card for convenience or points or whatever the reason you want to use it, make sure that you can pay it off in full at the end of the month. And just you can set it up automatically so that it withdraws the entire amount. And you just need to keep track of your spending so that you don't overspend with your credit card. If you end up in a situation where you do carry a balance on your credit card, then there are a couple of ways that financial advisors advise you to help get out of that debt. One of them is you make a sheet like this, you make a list like this, and you look at the interest rates, and then you look at what is the highest interest rate that I'm paying. And so you start by paying off the highest interest rate. If you're paying, 18, 19%, 20% on a credit card, and you're paying 3% on a college loan, pay the minimum amount for every loan each month, but start chipping away at the one, getting rid of the one that charges you the highest interest, because that interest is a killer, and you're just paying to the bank. And I personally think that's the wisest way to go. Dave Ramsey and others have suggested a different way, and that's fine. They say you take this sheet and you look at the outstanding balance and you choose the smallest one. So if you owe, $300 to one creditor and $3,000 to another. You make the minimum payment to all of them, but you get rid of that $300 debt first and you chip away at it. And then once that's gone, you take the money that you were putting towards that and you work at the next biggest one. And every time you get rid of the next biggest debt, you end up being able to take more money and get rid of all of your debt. So that's called snowballing. And the advantage of snowballing is that it happens more quickly and you get more excited about it and you're more likely to stick with it. The disadvantage is you may end up paying more in interest if some of your bigger debts are those higher interest loans. But it doesn't matter how much you pay in interest if you're never going to pay off any of the loans. I mean, if you never get the momentum to pay them off. And so you'll just be trapped in this never-ending cycle of debt. So those are two ways that you can actually gauge, okay, what do I pay off first? When dealing with debt, set a target date to get out of debt. Installment loans, excluding your mortgage, should be less than 10% of your take-home pay. So you should never take loans more than 10% of your take-home pay, not including your mortgage. And your goal should be to eliminate all installment debt. So if you have 10% now and you think, great, I'm under it, or I have 9%, try and get 0%. And your mortgage payment, including your taxes and insurance, should not exceed 30% of your take-home pay. That's a general rule. In California, sometimes it is higher. And then sometimes people say, well, what about consolidation loans? Because they look at consolidation loans where you have five different loans, all at different interest rates, some are higher or lower, and somebody says, well, we'll give you a loan to pay off all your other loans. And then you just have one payment, and the interest rate will be better than all these other loans, and then it'll be great. And you think, oh, this is wonderful. I want to get a consolidation loan. But it only works if you change your habits. If you get the loan and then you keep on spending on those other credit cards, it doesn't work. And so it can be a very dangerous thing. So stop careless spending. And then let me just go over some practical steps for dealing with debt or how to get out of debt. These are on page 16 of the packet that you have. The first one would be stop all new indebtedness immediately. Just stop overspending. Second one is commit to put all extra income to pay off debt. This has got to be a priority for both the husband and the wife. One of you can't say, hey, we're paying off the debt. And the other one's like, I'm spending like there's no tomorrow. So you got to be on the same page with this. It's got to be your goal. I mean, I had a neighbor who during a recession decided that he lost his job and he's got to pay his mortgage and he couldn't get a job and he's trying to figure out what to do. And he just spent every day and he would go on Facebook Marketplace and look for good things that people were giving away for free, because I guess there's a whole section of free items. He would go pick them up, put them in his garage, clean them up, fix them up, take nice pictures of them, and then he would sell them on Facebook Marketplace. He did that for years and got through the recession until he could get a job and was able to pay his mortgage. I'm just saying there are some creative ways that you can do to try and help you get out of debt. So you can sell as many depreciating items as practical. I had a church member come to me one time and she says, can you help me understand this? I bought a refrigerator from a furniture store and I bought it using their credit agreement. And she said that it was high interest and it was over 20% interest. And she had missed a couple of payments and they had really big penalties for missing payments. But she goes, I don't understand it. I have been paying on it for almost a year, and I still owe more than the refrigerator originally cost. She was in a never-ending cycle. And sometimes, I mean, the answer is, okay, I need to go and get a used refrigerator off of eBay or something like that and sell this while it still has some value and pay off what it can and then continue to pay it off. There's Facebook Marketplace. You can buy things. Some things are free. There's a, if you're a member of Grace Church, there's an opportunity sheet that you can access by putting your membership information in on the website. Go to the opportunity sheet. Every week, there are items people give away. And every week, you can put it in there saying, hey, I'm looking for a refrigerator. If anyone has an extra one, let me know. There are people in this church who would love to get rid of their extra refrigerator and get their electric bill down. And so, so you'd be amazed at what you can find. You do have to be careful. And I remember that there was some seminary friends of mine who, when they were in seminary, he needed a dryer. He just got married and needed a washer and dryer, and he found a dryer on the opportunity sheet, and it was like $100. It was pretty fair price, and so he went. And he called the lady, and she said, sure. And so she took the money from him and then put it in her pocket. And then she says, it's in the back of the garage. She opened up the garage door. It's full of stuff. So the two of them, they pulled out all the stuff from the garage, got the dryer out, put it in the truck, got it to the guy's apartment, and then realized it's an electric dryer and he has gas hookups. So he went back. They put it back in the truck, went back to the lady, knocked on her door. They could still see his money in her pocket. And he explained to her what had happened. And she said, well, allow me to be the first one to help teach you a lesson about home ownership. Bye. And she shut the door. So sometimes, I mean, you got to live with what's going on. And they had a garage sale the next day, and he sold it. And I think he got most of his money back. But anyway, so... you just have to realize you have to be careful with things like that. So even at a church, people will have different ways of helping you that may not be the way you think you need to be helped. Closely examine food costs. There's some who say that most people can cut 15% out of their food budget without going hungry, without eating less. So just by using coupons or eating out less, or cutting out expensive coffees, you should be able to cut back quite significantly there if you need to. Begin do-it-yourself services. Wash your own car. Do your own gardening. Paint it yourself as much as you can. Make do with what you have, and don't feel like you need to go out and buy something new. Set a goal date to be free of debt. After a couple months of budgeting, you should be able to see, okay, project forward. When can we actually be free from debt? And set that as a goal and work towards it and see if you can actually get there earlier. Make it a family effort. If you have kids and they want to go to camp, ask them to contribute. Do a lemonade stand. Have them do the gardening for you. Give them opportunities. If they have grandparents who are giving them money for Christmas, and they got to want to say, well, do you want to spend some of that towards camp? You know, maybe you should spend 10% of the camp fee. Do you really want to go? See if your kids, how invested they are, and also include them in on your financial goals. Say, hey, mom and dad got ourselves into a difficult thing financially, and we're kind of underwater, and we're trying to make this work, and we want you to go to camp, and we will help you go to camp. But do you really want to go to camp? Are you willing to contribute towards this? Would you be willing to do some chores around the house to help earn some money to help pay for camp? You know, and get them excited about this. I know one family that had certain debt, and they were trying to get rid of it, and they took those paper chains that you glue, and then you take another piece of paper and you glue it, and you pick, you know, and you get this long chain. They made this chain with all the months. Every ring was a month that they wanted to get out of debt, and they hung the chain from their inner dining room over the railing over that held the curtains. And so there was this paper chain. And every month they could say to the kids, okay, you get to tear off another piece of the chain. And then some months, oh, you tear off two. You know, we were able to put more. And the kids got to see the journey of getting rid of the debt. And so include the family. So I want to move on to balancing assets. So this is a simple thing, shouldn't take much long, but the main principle here is that your assets should be worth more. Like if you sold everything, you should actually have more, you should have money in the bank, right? Your debts shouldn't outweigh your assets, especially if your debts are less than 10%, right? But so what is your home worth? Do you have a farm or a ranch, or do you have rental property, or what are other things? What about an automobile? How much is that worth? How much do you owe on it, and so forth? So what are your assets and what are your liabilities? What are they worth, and how much do you owe on them? And then you can do that with other things, jewelry or cash or whatever. You add up all of your assets and you look at your total assets and your total liabilities, and you should be able to subtract them, and that's your net worth. What's amazing is that many Africans who have nothing have a higher net worth than many Americans. And to tell them that, they can't understand that, but because many Americans actually have a negative net worth. If they were to sell everything and pay off all their debts, they still would owe money. And so you need to avoid that. All right. I want to talk about large purchases, because this is something that people are like, how are we ever going to do this? And so I want to start with cars, and then we'll talk about homes or houses. So first of all, Jim Rickard has this great thing. One of the things I love about his thing, and if you know Jim Rickard, he used to teach at the Masters University. He used to be on the board there. He was the president of the board for a number of years. He has a financial ministry, I mentioned it before, called Stewardship Services. They do taxes for pastors and missionaries. It's a great organization. I'm not talking about his son, who's also named Jim Rickard, who's a soccer coach at the college. I'm talking about Jim Rickard Sr. But anyways, he has this car buying principle called 2-4 junk. 2-4 junk. And this is how it works. You purchase a 2-year-old car, and let's just say I adjusted these numbers, so I based it off his principles, but the paper that I had is so old. If you see it there, it's on page 12, but he says, buy a 2-year-old Oldsmobile Cutlass. So anyways, for $11,000 is what he said. So I said, okay, let's say you buy a 2-year-old car for $15,000. I think you can buy a 2-year-old car for $15,000. It may be a stretch, but it depends on what car, right? So anyways, you put $3,000 down, and you finance it at 10%. Now, you can get a car loan nowadays for 7% if your credit is good. But if your credit is poor, you might be paying as much as 13%, 14%. So I just did 10% as an average. And if it's less, it actually works better. So anyways, but plan on keeping it for 4 years. So you don't buy a new car. As soon as you buy a new car, you drive it off the lot, 25% of the value, gone. Okay. So you buy a 2-year-old car, and then that first car, you put $3,000 down on it, which means you owe $12,000 because it's a $15,000 car. Make sense so far? Okay, keep with me. I know, it's Sunday morning, we just had donuts, but here we go. So you're financed for 36 months, 10% interest. It comes out to $387 per month. Your total then, after you pay for it with interest and everything, is $16,939. So you paid almost $2,000 in interest, but that's how it goes. That's what interest does for you. You pay more. But now it's paid for. Now, the mistake that people make is they say, oh, I've paid off my car. I've got all this extra money. What do you want to do with it? But they're not thinking about the next car. And so the principle goes like this. You continue to make that payment of $387 to yourself. You open up a savings account and you make that payment every month for the next 12 months. And you'll end up with $4,644. Not only that, but if you have an interest-bearing account, even for 1 year, you'll get an extra $87. So if you sell the car at the end of the fourth year, and let's say it's a $15,000 car, you had it for 4 years, now you only get $5,000 for it. Hopefully you get more, but let's just say you only get $5,000 for it. You'll have $9,700 available. So that's the end of the fourth year. The way this principle works is that after 8 years, you'll never have to get a car loan again. You'll always be able to buy a car for cash. And it works like this. Now that you have this $9,700, you're thinking to yourself, okay, do I put the minimum down on another car? No, put it all down on the next car. So let's say your second car is $16,000 car. The loan then, because you're putting $9,731 on it, your loan is only $6,269. So you finance it at about the same as you've been paying before. That's the second mistake people make, is they say, well, I can get a 3-year loan again, but I can cut it in half. It'll be so much less. Nope, you're used to paying about $380 a month. Keep it at that same amount. So you finance it over 18 months and 10% interest. Now it's $377 a month, and you end up paying a total of $16,508. Notice this time you only paid $500 worth of interest, which is great. It's a shorter amount of time. It's a lesser amount of money because you put more down. Now you still have you bought a two-year-old car again. You have another, you want to keep it for 4 years. You've got it paid off in a year and a half. So you've got 2.5 years to save up. In that savings account, continue to pay $377 into that account every month, and you've saved up $11,310 after 2.5 years. Your interest at 3% in that account would be $471. Let's say you sell that $16,000 car 4 years later for $6,000. Now you have $17,781. So you go and buy car number three. This is now the beginning of year nine. 8 years have gone by, and you buy a $17,000 car. You buy it with cash. You've got $781 left over, or whatever it said before. $781. But now save $400 a month for 4 years. You'll have $19,200 after 4 years. You'll put away, you'll get interest of $1,200. And then you'll have $20,456 to go buy a car cash. And you continue to save like that, and you will never have to get a car loan again. That's the 2-4 junk principle. What I like about it is that you should be thinking about this for all kinds of major purchases. Appliances are going to wear out, and you don't want to have to go get a loan to buy an appliance. So having a fund that you're dropping into for your next appliance, or if you need an appliance repair, all of a sudden, and really, if you're thinking about it, it's all the Lord's money. So now you need to repair the appliance. You're like, all right, the Lord has want us to help out an appliance guy, you know, and we've got the money. It's the Lord's money, and we're going to get an appliance guy, and we're going to use some of this funds that have just been sitting there for the appliance guy. What an opportunity we have. Scott's shaking his head no. Never thought that ever. Yeah. You've never repaired any appliances, huh? Okay, so let's talk about home purchases. Okay, before I do, though, any questions about the 2-4 junk principle? I want to make sure that that was somewhat clear. Yes? Yes. Yeah. Yeah, so cars should last longer than 2 years. And most cars today should last 6 years. They really should. And you might have repairs, and that's a risk that you take. And that's a risk you take with any car. What you can do is sometimes you can look for a car that has some sort of warranty with it. And if it's a newer car, sometimes it still has a warranty. The other thing you could do is, you know, and it's called the 2-4 junk principle, but you don't, if your car is still going well, you don't need to actually sell it after the fourth year. If, as long as the depreciation is not going to go down too much, and I depreciated them a lot in those years, the more you save, you have a car fund. So if you do need, you know, and rust, the nice thing about rust is it does take a time. I know salt and damages cars and all that, but, you know, my first car was 20 years old when I got it. And I drove it as a daily driver for the better part of another 8 years, through high school, through college, and then some. So I'm driving a 28-year-old car. I still have that car. My grandfather bought it. I got it from him. I still have my first car. So my brother and sister had no interest in it. They thought it was a big boat. I like sailing. I like boats. So anyways, but I'm just saying that you'd be amazed. And really, it's amazing the way they make cars nowadays. Okay. All right. Does that help? Okay. So let's talk about a house purchase. And then I'll, first of all, before we talk about house purchase, let's deal with the question, right? The question is, I got to move out of California because I'll never be able to afford a house in California. And so we're going to move to Texas, Tennessee, Idaho, you choose, right? South Carolina. And then we can finally afford a house. All right? That's the question, right? You've heard it. You know people who've left, right? I mean, you visit Montana, and they're not happy to see you visiting as a Californian. So I went to Montana, and I'm in Bozeman, and I look around, and I said to somebody, I was visiting a church there, and I said, "Wow, each direction I look, it looks like a postcard. It's so beautiful here." And he doesn't want me to like his state, so he starts to downsell it. And so he's like, "Yeah, we wait all year for a day like today." And I said to him, "You know, when you downsell your state, it only makes you want to come there more. You know, I mean, it's so." But anyways, here's the thing. Yes, it's true that in California, because of the house prices are so high, you most likely won't be able to afford a house in your 20s or maybe even in your 30s. It's true. Whereas if you move to another state, you might be able to afford a house in your 20s or in your 30s. Now, first of all, there's nothing in the Bible that says you have to have a house. So you don't think that you have to have a house. Secondly, I don't think it's a bad idea or desire to have a house. I think it's a fine desire. I'm not trying to say you should just put that away. But you need to consider certain things. And for one, in California, houses appreciate at about 7 or 8% a year based on a 30-year average. Whereas other states that I've mentioned, they appreciate more like a 2 or 3% per year. And I know this is anecdotal, but I'll just say it anyways. My brother bought in the 90s, moved away, bought a house in Texas, and upgraded to another house, and has lived there for a number of years. And he was able to buy a house in his 20s. He's 2 years older than me. I was only able to buy a house here in California when I was in my 40s. But 10 years after I bought my house, I had more equity in my house than he did in his Texas home. Now, that won't always be true, and timing matters, but I'm just saying that if you get it out of your mind, and when I say equity, that basically if I were to sell my house and he were to sell his house, the money that we'd both have sitting in our banks, I would have more after 10 years than he had after 25 years in his home. Now, does that mean you shouldn't move out of California? I don't know. But I'll say this. When somebody says, "Oh, I'll never be able to afford to live here," and "Oh, it's so blue," and all these things, right? I would encourage you to pray that if the Lord wants you to move, that he finds something drawing you somewhere else, a church opportunity. You should be thinking about church more than your house. If you're moving to another place, there should be a really solid church because that is a biblical thing. And so should you move away? Maybe, but ask the Lord to draw you away. Because if the primary reason you're leaving is because of discontentment has a way of following you everywhere. Because guess what? The world is corrupt and being corrupted more and more. So I hope that's helpful there. Let's talk about purchasing a home. And this is where Jim Rickard really kind of goes off the rails, because he talks about two examples, a $60,000 house and a $100,000 house. Okay? What can I say? I got this packet when I was in seminary. I wrote him last week and I said, "Hey, do you have any updated sheets? I'd love to have them." And it was a busy week for him, I imagine, because it's the middle of April. But anyway, so let's look at the $100,000 one, and you could just add a zero on there if you want, or you could times it times five or whatever you're looking at. But here are just a couple of things you should know about loans when it comes to home loans, okay? So your payment plus your principal and interest. So that's what you're paying the bank, is the interest, your principal, which goes against the loan. And then you times that times 12 months. If you look at example two, the $100,000 one, your payment's like $734. It's $8,000. It's almost $9,000 a year. After 30 years, you've paid $264,000 for a $100,000 house. So you've paid $164,000 in interest. Okay, that's at 8%. Right now, interest rates are probably between 6 and 7. Okay, so I'm sorry. here we go. Let's say you add $166 per month to your payment, $166, okay? Then your payment becomes $900 per month. What happens is that after 12 months, you're paying $10,000 a year, and then after 17 years, you've paid $183,000 total, which means the $100,000 house cost you $83,000 in interest instead of $164,000. In interest. So you've cut 13 years off your mortgage and you've saved half the interest just by adding a small amount each month. Amazing, huh? You can also get a 15-year loan that automatically does that for you, and the interest rate might be lesser, but then you're locked into it and it's tough to get out of it. But there's another way of doing this as well. Here's the summary. So, yeah, I just explained that anyway. So here we go. There's another way of doing that's by biweekly rather than monthly. So if you look at a biweekly mortgage, if you have an $80,000 mortgage at 10%, then your payment would be $702 per month. After 30 years, you paid $172,000. But, you know, there are 12 months in a year, but there are 52 weeks. So if every month had 4 weeks, then a 12-month year would be 48 weeks. But we have 52 weeks, so there's actually an extra four-week period. So some people are paid every 2 weeks. If you set up your mortgage to come out of your paycheck every 2 weeks or out of your bank account, rather than once a month, you'll get an extra two payments in a year. And just by doing that, you'll end up paying it off almost 10 years earlier. Okay? And you'll save on this, according to this $80,000 loan, you'll save something like $62,000 in interest. Okay. I'd like to move on and talk about giving, but any questions about large purchases? Okay. Yes. Yeah, I don't have separate bank accounts for every large purchase. I do have a high yield bank account that earns 5%, and I just put money in there as I have it. That's right. Yeah, yeah. And once you do it for long enough, it just becomes, you know, the reserve. Yeah, and you kind of know how much reserves you need. Yes. Yeah, so the question is, how do you biblically consider necessities versus comfort? I think let's talk about giving, and then let's talk about necessities versus comfort. Okay, remind me when I get to the end of this. Okay, so giving in the Old Testament, Israel is required to tithe, and you may have heard different people talking about tithing, even tithing for today. Most of those people are covenant theologians. They're from churches that are covenantal, like Presbyterian Church and so forth, because they see more continuity between the Old Testament and the New Testament. So they take the word tithe from the Old Testament, they apply it to the church for today, and they say that it was 10%. In reality, if you were to go to a Jew during Old Testament times and say, man, you guys used to have to pay 10% mandatory, and they'd say, 10%? What are you talking about? It was more like 25%. You say, well, how do you figure? Well, because they were supposed to give 10% of their income to the Levites, according to Leviticus 27:30. They were supposed to give another 10% for national feasts and holidays, according to Deuteronomy 14:22-27. And then in addition to that, every third year, they were to take a special offering of 10% that was given for the needy, and that's Deuteronomy 14:28-29. So the average of that would be more like 23% per year. And add to that, you know, other mandatory things like not taking grain out of the corners of your field. There were a lot of other things set up for people that was mandatory, that it was closer to 25% of their annual income that was actually set away for the giving. Now, remember that their giving was also, their government was their church. The nation of Israel was the theocracy, so those who led the temple worship were also their governmental leaders. And on top of that mandatory giving, they were encouraged voluntary giving, making provision for the poor. Deuteronomy 15:11 says, "The poor will never cease to be in the land. Therefore, I command you, saying, you shall freely open your hand to your brother, to your needy and your poor in your land." And so there was free will giving that was strongly encouraged in the Old Testament. In the New Testament, there were instructions for required giving, but that was to the government. Romans 13 and Matthew 22, giving to Caesar what is Caesar's. That's paying your taxes and making sure that you're paying duty on items and all these sort of things. But when the New Testament speaks about giving to the Lord, it speaks about giving from the heart, free will giving, not under compulsion, cheerfully, discreetly, not letting your left hand know what your right hand is doing, giving with a heart full of love, generously, regularly, caring especially for the believers. So you see the verses that are associated with those. And you see that this idea that you're giving, you're not under compulsion. You don't have to give a certain amount. For some people, giving 10% at a time where they're in college or have expenses or in debt, it might be too much for them. There are other people who are at a different stage in their life, and giving 10% might be too little. Why is the Lord blessing you? And should you give? And you should give cheerfully, discreetly, not really letting others know what you're doing, giving with a heart of love. It's regular, it's generous, it's caring. New commandment I give you, that you love one another. In 2 Corinthians 8:10, we have an interesting passage where Paul reminds them, this is after Paul had started to collect an offering, but then they had some discord with Paul. He had the severe letter. Then he wrote them in 2 Corinthians. There was reconciliation. And now he reminds them about their giving. And he talks about how giving is profitable for them, 2 Corinthians 8:10. The NASB says, to your advantage. ESV is beneficial. The word there originally meant to bring together. It had the idea of people coming to help and bringing their items together for an advantage. Like if your crops are brought together, it was beneficial for everyone because you could share the storage and you could share the security and you could look out for one another. And Paul's point is here that it's to your advantage if you invest in that which advances the kingdom. And when it comes to finances, one of the difficulties that we face here as Americans is that when we have more than we need and we're saving up to be responsible for things like retirement and so forth, there comes a stage when you ask yourself, when can I cut back on saving for things that are going to burn and start spending more and investing more in eternity? And one of the reasons that I love 2 Corinthians 8:10 and the whole context that passes, and I preached a message on this, you can listen to online, but it's this idea that Paul is he's not saying, hey, you got to give. He's saying, oh man, I just got the best investment that you have ever heard of. This would be so profitable for you, so much to your advantage if you started investing in things that will last for eternity. Doesn't mean you're going to have financial blessing now. But God is a rewarder. And there's also a passage in 1 Corinthians chapter 3. I did a sermon on, I think it's verses, I don't see it here, but I think it's verses 12 through 17 that talks about rewards. And it's a tricky thing because if you're doing it for the reward and it's a selfish motive, you're giving up your reward if you're doing it publicly or whatever. But there are eternal benefits. There are eternal benefits when you're investing in the Lord's things. And so I would encourage you to do that joyfully and to see that, Lord, help me to be a good steward of what you've given me, that I might really do what's pleasing to you and honoring to you, and help me to do it from not a a begrudging heart or a heart under compulsion, but freely, willingly, generously, in a way that honors you and helps others and invests in eternal things. He says at the end of verse 10, 2 Corinthians 8, speaking to the Corinthians, you were the first to begin a year ago, not only to do this, but also to desire to do that. It was their desire. They wanted to help. And what's amazing about that context, too, is they were helping Christians who were under persecution in Jerusalem, who were Jews. So God had orchestrated it so that the most proud people on the earth who had previously had the kingdom, people come through them. You had to become a Jew first. Now, Jews were Christians, but Gentiles were Christians, and God put the Jews in a predicament to where they needed help, and the Gentiles were only too happy to help, bringing great unity in that first century church. And Jesus said, when you give to the poor, do not let your left hand know what your right hand is doing, so that your giving will be in secret, as your Father who sees what is done in secret will reward you. So again, there's this idea of, hey, there is this investment that you should know about. Questions. I've got some from last week if you've got more, but there was one that, did I answer that one? Julian, did I answer your question about giving and about purchasing for comfort or for yeah, so the short answer is this. You want something comfortable? You have the freedom to do it. The Lord provides the finances for you. Never go into debt for a pleasure item. You're not going to go loan for a boat or a motorhome or a vacation. You don't need those things, right? But if you have the resources and you'd like to use that for something like that and enjoy the creation around you and what God has provided for you, you have the freedom to do that. But be in prayer that God will help you to keep that balance between investing in what's here that will... I mean, motorhomes tend to break down. Eternal heavenly riches don't. So it's up to you. You've got the freedom. All right. Another question. Yes.
What advice
do you give to a young married couple if they don't have the same idea for finances? Yeah. So a young married couple who doesn't have the same view on giving or finances or strategy or so forth. It's so great that on the day she got married, she vowed before God and everyone that everyone who present that she would follow her husband, that she would submit to him. I'm going to tell you a story about a couple that got a divorce. They were married for 26 years and they got a divorce. And I was talking to the lady years after the divorce. I said, what do you regret for your marriage? And she said, I regret that I didn't submit more. I said, what does that look like? Give me an example. She said, my husband was terrible with money. He made very bad investments. And I could tell beforehand he lost hundreds and thousands of dollars with really poor investments. But I never submitted to him. I dug my heels in and fought him tooth and nail. And I was right. But I never won. She said, if he had something he wanted to do and he asked for my opinion and I said, don't do it, and I dug my feet in and he did it and it worked out well because there were some investments he did that worked out well, it was like, yeah, you didn't want to do this, but it turned out the way I thought it would. And if she goes, but if I was right and he was wrong, then he was belittled by me and it put more stress on our marriage. She said, money doesn't matter. I married this man. I wish I would have just said, I'm not sure that's the best move, but I trust you, and I'm going to be right alongside you, and I'm with you 100%. She says, because then if we would have done well with the investment, I could rejoice with him. And if we would have failed with the investment, we could have like been together on it as well. So again, that's anecdotal, but submitting to your husband, it does have a design. And, you know, how much you give, if you're not in agreement about that, ultimately, it's the husband's responsibility because he's the head of the home and he'll be judged for what is the way he handles the finances in the home.
All right. Yes, last question.
Do you have recommendations for high yield savings accounts at 5%?
High yield savings accounts at 5%. Yes. Talk to a financial advisor. I'm not a financial advisor. But there are plenty of people in this church that use financial advisors and have them, and there are funds that you can invest in, and yeah. So yeah. Sometimes you have to get a minimum amount to get into that fund. Sometimes you gotta, you know, but you can work towards that. Yeah. All right. Let's pray. Thank you, Father, again, for this time together. We do thank you for some of these practical tools that others have spent so much time in simplifying and helping us to understand them. And we pray, Lord, that you would continue to help us to have a heart for you and a heart after what you would want us to have. And we pray, Father, for couples that are considering marriage. And we know that it would be wrong for us to give them the impression that they have to be have all their finances completely worked out and settled for the rest of their lives before they get married. And yet there is a responsibility that they do have, that they're not just walking into something that is going to be a black hole of indebtedness and trouble and no way, no clear path out. So help us to strike that balance, and that couples would be able to get married even though they're living on very frugal budgets. And yet they would have the right kind of stewardship ability to honor you in their decisions. We do pray for unity in marriages. We don't take it lightly that there are differences. We thank you for those differences, and we pray that there be harmony. And pray this in Jesus' name. Amen. Thank you.